You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel. Coming up this week in episode 324, Juliet reports back on her holiday with the stars. Which is more bizarre, sacking Frank de Boer or appointing Roy Hodgson? And if Top of the Pops was revived, would anyone bother to watch it? We look at music on television in 2017. It's all coming up after Prefab Sprout and Bonnie.
I spend the days of my vanity lost in heaven and I'm lost to earth. Didn't give you minutes, not even moments. All my life in a tower of form, shaded feelings, I don't believe you. When you were there before my eyes, no one planned it, took it for granted. I count the hours since you slipped away. I count the hours that I lie awake. I count the minutes and the seconds too. Don't hold you, broken soldiers.
Again, stretch the limit of calling a single a hit if it reaches the UK top 100, which is stretching. You know,
I mean, there are degrees. To the Guinness Book of Hit Singles, it has to be top 75. But go on.
I know. Well, if we do go to top 100, then Prefab Sprout had a run of 20 hits between 1984 and 1997. Mm. Interestingly, out of those 20 top 100 records, only one made it into the top 10 through that period.
Oh, was that...
King of Rock and Roll.
Rock and Roll, yeah, yeah. Of course it was.
Now, that was a track from their second album, Steve McQueen, released as Two Wheels Good in the USA. Mm. Paddy McAleen, inspired writer, singer and musician. One of my favourite bands of all time, Prefab Sprout and Bonnie. And I remember when that album came out in the UK, I was working on Weekending and other shows at the BBC. Mm. And I used to commute by train, and I would drive from my home in Berkshire to Ascot Railway Station. And the distance was just enough time for me to hear tracks 2 and 3, Bonnie and Appetite, from that Prefab Sprout album, about 8 minutes. And for about a year, they were the only two tracks I played on that journey. So rather embedded in my memory.
Absolutely. I'm glad I'm not the only one that does that, that times journeys by certain tracks. There are certain albums, when I used to drive to work in Tenterden, that was a 42-minute journey. There were certain albums that absolutely perfectly fitted the journey, and I was a big fan of them. There was a particular Stereo Lab album which would literally start as I started the engine and would finish as I stopped the engine at the other end, which is always good. My top test, by the way, I used to drive a car that had a tape deck in it, so this is going back a bit, but not that long ago. I was devastated when it was written off. We all were. And so it was written off about, oh, I don't know, 5 years ago, I think.
I remember,
but I was still listening
incident.
To yes indeed, it was not ideal, but anyway, so I used to listen to lots of things on tape around that time when I first started driving from where I lived to Bexhill, which was about half an hour at the time. I had all these tapes, because Wax Factor in Brighton, the shop which I loved, despite once having split up with someone on their front doorstep, had a let's get rid of all of our tapes sale, because this is long before they became hipster again, the tapes. And so they sold lots of things off for 20p a throw, and that's how I first got hold of Remaining Light by Talking Heads. For a mere 20p, I would listen to it. I listened to the first side of it all the way sort of to the journey and back. And so my top tip for any young upcoming bands is make sure your album fits on one side of a C45 tape. It is so irritating to have 10 tracks of an album and have to have a spare on the other side. So as we are, I hope, experiencing a tape revival, make sure that you fit that in, young hep cats in upcoming popular beat combos.
Sound advice, indeed. So, yeah, Paddy McAloon, absolute expert on love,
genius,
loss,
yeah,
the pleasure and pain in relationships. Welcome to the podcast from the Parish Council. It's episode 324. I'm Terence Dackham. And, yes, back from a week essentially living La Vida Loca on a holiday in Oxford. It's Juliet Harris.
Hello, everyone. Yes, indeed, I am. Small B back, big B back, block capitals back, exclamation mark, as Smash Hits would have once had it. Indeed, a pleasure to be back.
And now, Jules, in what can only be described as a week of unrestrained hedonism, you've been hobnobbing with every well-known person who inhabits the Oxford area.
Indeed, I had not expected this to be such a celebby holiday. I say this, I hung out with a lot of famous people. They didn't know I was hanging out with them.
Oh.
But that's not holding me back. Anyway, so but I stayed in Oxford for a week. Haven't been before. Excellent city. Very much enjoyed its public transport systems and valuing of knowledge, and large science parks on the outside. Who knows what will happen in 18 months' time. But anyway, very much enjoyed it. I went to the excellent truck store on the Cowley Road in Oxford. The Cowley Road is sort of quite a studenty, slightly alternative area. It had some excellent charity shops, which we'll hear more about a bit later on. But I went and saw this truck store, which is one of the best record shops I've ever been to. It was really great. If you're in the Oxford area and you like that sort of thing, it did CDs as well, so that will please you, Terence. And it had a new section and a pre-owned section. It also had comedian Stuart Lee browsing amongst the racks, which is very entertaining, simply because everyone, there were lots of people, you know, of my age, I would say, people in their 30s, perhaps some in their 20s, and a couple in their 40s, and everyone, I was well aware of the fact that everyone, including me, was visibly trying very hard to act normally. And so there were lots of us trying to act normally, including the girl behind the counter and the chap behind the counter. And after he left, several people looked up, and the girl kind of exhaled in a way that suggested she'd just run a marathon. And when I spoke to her when I was looking through some records a few seconds later, and she said, "I think I'm still recovering from that." And then explained that actually Stuart Lee is doing a few gigs in Oxford at a theatre, and that she and her boyfriend were going to go and see him later on that evening. And she said that she was very worried that she might not have put the right CDs in boxes for him, because she was a bit overcome by the fact it was comedian Stuart Lee, who seemed entirely normal. And I think everyone was very well aware, and you say oh, I didn't hang out with celebrities. I think everyone was very well aware of the fact that this guy just wanted to go into a shop and buy some records and didn't want to be pestered. So And on that note, I had thought in my own mind that I might try and do a Radiohead-themed tour of Oxford and visit, because as regular listeners now, I'm a huge fan of Radiohead, much to your occasional chagrin, although you have it.
I'm being rehabilitated.
It's glorious to hear. So I had a look around Oxford. I thought, go to a few places maybe. I was with my parents. This is the key to my behaviour in this story. With my parents, we were walking towards Jericho, which is a kind of a popular alternative area of Oxford, famous for its Inspector Morse connections and also generally being a slightly kind of more happening part of Oxford. And I had thought, you know, well, maybe I'll do that tomorrow. And as we crossed the road, a man on the opposite side of the road walked past us to go around the corner, and it very much was Tom York from Radiohead. There was no one else it could be. It quite plainly was him. And after he went, I said to my parents, do you know, I don't think I need bother with that Radiohead tour now. What is going to top walking past Tom York on Little Clarendon Street in Oxford, really? And I didn't say anything, because what was he doing? He was going somewhere, I think. He was having enough. And also, I was with my parents, and my dad said to me, oh my God, is it that whining bloke, after he'd gone past? And then he explained to me how he was only actually the second best whining bloke, because the chap who my dad describes as Morris, and the rest of us know as Morrissey, he really is the top whining bloke. And I have every confidence that my dad would have explained this to Tom York in person, and I probably would not have lived to survive the experience, having died of pure embarrassment. Well, so had I been by myself, I don't think I would have said anything, because I think I would have just been too overcome. I stared at my shoes as he walked past, and in a way that was the ultimate Radiohead fan reaction, I think. So Oxford, unexpectedly starry, it turns out.
Well, when you told me that you crossed paths with these people, I was very grateful that you clarified the situation in your text to me, because you said, oh, I've seen Tom York of Radiohead, which I'm guessing was in case I got mixed up with Tom York, the car mechanic from Abingdon. And
well,
equally,
I'm never sure if you know these things or not, Terence. Do you remember that time we had to have that conversation about Tropical House? I never quite know the extent to which your popular culture claws extend.
Well, you see, you also said, oh, I saw Stuart Lee, the comedian, in Truck Records in a text to me. And I thought, ah, oh, good. You know, maybe you were thinking, you were referring to Stuart Lee, the chiropractor of Cowley. It's very, very helpful. However, I do take your point. Yet, somehow, I've managed to get over the age of 60 and actually gain the knowledge that Tom York is a singer with your Radiohead, and Stuart Lee is a popular comedian.
Indeed. But, you know, I make no apologies, Terence. I like to keep you in the loop at all times, and by your own admission as well. Occasionally, you know, as one moves through life, there are more things to remember in one's head, limited amounts of space. I'm trying to be here for you, Terence.
Of course, this whole Oxford Beano followed your birthday last week, and, of course, I sent you a birthday card. But
you did, and also an excellent present, which I was very pleased about. Thank you.
What an ordeal it is to choose a card these days. Years ago, it was simple. You went into a newsagent and there would be a small carousel of greetings cards, maybe a dozen celebrating birthdays. Mm-hmm. You picked the one with carnations on the front and you posted it. Now, W.H. Smith and Son has aisles and aisles, miles of aisles, if you will, of cards, acres of them. And the only way I could select a card for your birthday was by process of elimination. So obviously there was nothing from the humour section open to misinterpretation.
Absolutely.
Too risky.
And it would never be as funny as us.
Exactly. Nothing too lovey-dovey, inappropriate. No music or sort of turntably pictures or depictions of kind of music-related things, too obvious. Nothing even hinting at misogyny. No women with parasols or, you know, looking delicate. So I must have been in there an hour, Jules. And
they didn't have a women in DM section then.
They didn't. No, so absolute minefield. I ended up sending you a card that just had the words happy birthday on it. It's the tyranny of choice. It was absolutely exhausting.
Well, I am sorry for your ordeal. Had I known that it was going to be so traumatic for you, I would have intervened at an early stage, but I didn't actually know you were going to do anything, in my defence. The colour scheme was excellent on that card. There was a pleasing amount of orange. I enjoyed it. Well done. It's been on my mantelpiece with various other cards I've received, some of which did feature turntables, by the way. So there are some people who, you know, I do get a lot of turntable-themed kind of goods as presents and cards as presents from people, which, you know, I always welcome. I had an excellent conversation with my secretary at work about this, who is a very fine woman indeed, and I overheard a conversation with her and our receptionist as I was walking through to go out, and I was catching prices of cards, and then it was best summed up in the immortal line, "Oh, we did buy them a card for 29p, but we're only going to the evening do with them. We bought a £1.29 card for the people whose wedding we're actually going to." So apparently, my secretary prices cards depending upon the extent to which she's getting involved in an event. So if they're only going to the evening do, they bought a 29p card from Card Crazy. But because they were going to these people's wedding, they bought a nicer £1.29 card. When she gave me my birthday card, she'd written on the end envelope, "This costs more than 29p, lol," in brackets, which I was very pleased by. I bought my aunt a £4.65 birthday card, which people were visibly shocked by in the office. They didn't know such a thing existed. I didn't buy her one last year, and she got very cross about it. So I thought I'd kind of make up for the fact that I hadn't done. But yeah, so maybe, Terence, I should be asking you how much the card was. I love the idea of people literally pricing their love for people. Isn't that great?
Well, I tell you, they're very expensive for what they are. Exactly. A piece of card folded in half.
Yeah, absolutely. I did buy my friend a card once that said, "I love you so much, I bought you this folded piece of paper to wish you a happy birthday." I had that written on the front, although I paid money for that, and actually I could have made that myself, couldn't I, really? It is very peculiar, isn't it? Someone somewhere is making a complete fortune at the expense of people like us that have to spend half an hour choosing something that says happy birthday on it. A friend of mine and I used to send each other inappropriate cards, irrelevant cards. I got a With Sympathy card on my birthday once, and he passed his degree or something, so I sent him a very special nephew card. We often send each other irrelevant cards. "Good luck in your new home," but he sent that to me when I was ill once, if I remember correctly. So I'm always a big fan of sending inappropriate kind of. I think I got an "I love you, granddad" card once. I think that was kind of the climax of the inappropriate. I realised that nothing could top that in terms of irrelevant cards. So a fun game for all the family. Do try it at home.
A friend of mine from when I was about 20, 21, and we sent the same card to each other every Christmas.
Back
and forth for about... it went on for about 20 years, and then the post office lost it on the 21st year. So it all came to a crashing halt.
Oh, I'm so sorry for that. That's my friend Susan's... I think he's my friend Susan... One of her siblings, the husband sends his wife the same Christmas card every year and hides it in the house. It's some padded kind of, that's so terrible it's lovely apparently. He hides it in the house each year and sends every year she looks for it and can't find it, and every year he manages to outwit her and then give her the cards. So I think it's a lovely story.
Yeah, I love that sort of thing. It's excellent. We're back revealing which outstanding football analyst predicted the downfall of Frank de Boer before the season even began.
Eye-rolling sightings now had their teeth rotted with the sugary insincerity of that.
That's next after this utterly gorgeous track from K.D. Lang.
Yes, excellent, excellent stylings from Catherine Dorn. That was K.D. Lang. It was Constant Craving, taken from the album Ingenue. That's how I'm pronouncing it anyway. I spoke earlier about charity shops in Oxford.
Oh, yes.
So, as I think regular listeners know, my dear friends Tim and Susan run an excellent record shop called Wow and Flutter. Tim and I are on Twitter and we follow various people, excellent people that like to tweet things they've found at car boot sales, bargains they've found in charity shop. And Tim said to me the other day that we both agreed that both of us are starting to get slightly twisted up with rage at this, because it never happens to either of us. We're never in the right place at the right time. We, you know, whenever we look through charity shops, it's all remainder shack attack. You know, it's never stuff that is actually worth any money. And I went to this Oxfam on the Cowley Road. Of course, the Oxfam started in Oxford, the Oxford Committee Against Famine, or whatever it is. The words Oxford Committee of Famine in that anyway. And so I went into this Oxfam on the Cowley Road and thought, oh, I'll sit on the floor, I'll have a look. There isn't much here, but you know, maybe there'll be something. I did pick up, and I wouldn't say it was excellent. I'd say it was a curio at best, but it's worth having for 99p. A Heavenly, the record label, Right Said Fred covers album, Saint Etienne doing I'm Too Sexy, for example. And it was very curious, but quite weird, sort of weird in its own way. I also found this Ingenue by K.D. Lang, and I saw it and it was priced at $2.99, and it looked in good nick, and I thought, oh, well, you know, perhaps I ought to have this. Really, you know, I don't have any K.D. Lang on vinyl, I'd quite like it. I put a picture of it up on Twitter, and partly as a part of a long-standing joke with my friend Paul, who we go to boot sales together, and he always if I don't go, he always brings me back a present, and it's always taking the mickey out of the fact that he feels I am a stereotypical lesbian. So it's often Joan Armour trading LPs. I have quite a few Joan Armour trading LPs. He did also once one be Lesbian Vampire Killers as well, which I then hit him with. But he gave me this So I tweeted at him a picture of this song, you know, and said, I see your Joan Armour training, I raise you K.D. Lang. And he didn't know about K.D. Lang's kind of history, and I then got to tweet the K.D. Lang being shaved by Cindy Crawford Vanity Fair cover, which is one of my favourite photos of all time. But someone else then tweeted us and said, oh, that's a decent price for that. At which point I thought, so my spidey sense started tingling. So I went and looked at Discogs and looked it up, and looked at the very version that I've got. I've been taught how to do this. You check the code and all that kind of stuff. And it was the German pressing. It was the first pressing, the German pressing, that was released over here in the UK. And the cheapest one that was on Discogs, that was in, I think, not as good condition as mine, went for £20.
Gosh, okay, so you're a rich woman.
So unexpectedly, well, you know, I'm not exactly good at it, it's not my pension plan, but I was very impressed by the fact that I accidentally managed to find a bargain. So I do feel that I am one of them now, which is a nice feeling to have.
She's such a fantastic voice, and I love that collaboration that you brought to my attention last year, that album with Nico Case and Laura Veers.
Oh yes, that's great, wonderful, album, isn't it? She's you know, to be still producing that level of work so far into her career is excellent. I'm really impressed.
A modest person who had been brought up properly almost certainly wouldn't mention that he has moved into pole position in the great parish council pre-season football predictions by reminding everyone that he nominated Frank de Boer as the first managerial sacking of the new season. Now, in many ways, perhaps, we shouldn't be surprised that a Premiership manager has been relieved of his duties after only four games. But bearing in mind, de Boer was only appointed on the 26th of June, so he's been sacked 10 weeks later. Crystal Palace only played four games and lost them all. So the question that seems to come out of this, which is the terrible decision? To sack the bloke after only four games, or if he's that bad, was it an even worse decision to appoint him in the first place?
Well, it's interesting, this. Initially you said, you did predict this correctly.
I
considered whether or not it might happen, because I thought Crystal Palace might have difficulties, but I thought he'd be quite good. I couldn't quite understand. He was taking on a team that were in some difficulty. It has to be said, they were kept up just about. Boy, was it Sam Allardyce?
Big Sam last year,
Big Sam, who then sailed off into the sunset, as is his wont. And Yeah, I thought, you know, obviously he's taking over Tim. He'll need some time. I think surely anyone with a brain in their head could have worked out that he would need some time. I mean, that was as clear as day. He was not inheriting a team that were in the best of shape or in the best of shape, sort of had the best of morale. I thought, you know, I think this will work out. However, it would seem not. I mean, he was extremely successful as a player. He won. He spent most of his professional career with the team that Fee Glover recently admitted on her podcast she once incorrectly pronounced as Ajax. he won five Eredivisie, however you pronounce the first, the Dutch first division title.
Very good.
And he won various, you know, UEFA Cups, Champions League, etc., etc. Looking at his managerial history, he'd managed Ajax for 6 years to some success, and Inter in 2016. If anything, Crystal Palace was Palace fans, but Crystal Palace was a bit of a step down from that, wasn't it? It wasn't exactly a step up. I thought, you know, give him a bit of time, he'll probably do quite well. They did not give him any time at all.
No, I mean, his early part of his managerial career was relatively successful. His last job before joining Crystal Palace, as you say, was at Inter Milan, appointed at the start of last season, last season, and he lasted 85 days, so about the same length of time as Palace. Now, it's said that Crystal Palace's owners wanted the team to play more expansive football in a more entertaining European style after, as you mentioned, the pragmatic approach of Sam Allardyce last season. But Big Sam did keep them up. And so to expect essentially the same squad of players, which we know...
Yeah, this is my point, yeah.
Under Sam Allardyce, you know you're going to be... It's kind of like, don't concede a goal. His first thought is defence, and then try and score on the break. So to expect essentially the same squad of players to suddenly play like Barcelona is probably too much of a leap of the imagination, because Christian Benteke has his merits, but, you know, and no doubt they're very good, but he's no Lionel Messi. You know, he's not going to be able to meander his way through five defenders and then, you know, score a chip from the edge of the penalty area.
Absolutely. And interestingly, your excellent point you make about if you haven't got the players to work, it's not going to work, has actually been described by their new manager. So there's this article here in the that well-known worldwide publication, the Croydon Advertiser. The new manager has said... So it says here that the Frank de Boer, the Dutchman, wanted to play a 3-4-3 setup, having had success previously at Ajax. however, the Crystal Palace players, they couldn't adapt to the new system. They played 4-2-3-1 for the last 3 years, and then Sam had them doing 3-5-2 at the end of last season, which is a slightly more exotic version of 4-4-2. It's the chicken tikka of football with the formations, isn't it? And the new manager has said... it's very difficult to impose a style of play if you don't have the players to play it. That's pretty obvious. I've seen quite a lot of Crystal Palace over the last 4-5 years, particularly my 4 years working with England. Clue. I have seen Palace progress, and also many of the players who are still here and improved. I think I have a clear idea of what they're good at and what they can do, so our style needs to be one that helps us win football matches. So that was Roy Hodgson. Upcoming 70-year-old young buck is now taking over at Crystal Palace.
By the way, I just wanted to throw this in. I know they get paid heaps of money, but there are still personal difficulties for managers when they're sacked so speedily. Frank de Boer's daughter has just enrolled in college in London.
Oh, for goodness
sake.
She's
decided to stay while the de Boer family are already back in Holland. These are the things that we don't usually think of. So it seems after de Boer was asked to leave, the Crystal Palace chairman sounded out Sam Allardyce to check if he'd come back. And when he demurred, they turned to, as you say, Roy Hodgson, his 21st managerial appointment. And of course, he's brought Ray Lewington along with him. Now, what are they expecting? No doubt the Barcelona style is to be thrown out, though that's what they wanted 2 months ago.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hodgson, yeah, he is 70 years old, but that's no big deal because Arsene Wenger is 67.
I take that back slightly.
Well, it's okay, but Sir Alex was in his early 70s when he retired. But can the appointment of Roy Hodgson be seen as anything but a panic buy? You know, the sort of failed bunch of flowers bought a petrol station on Christmas Eve, you know, as a late present. But
I have to say, I do find it a little bit rich that Roy Hodgson is saying, oh, well, that style of play was never going to work with those players. Having experienced Roy Hodgson's efforts with England, Roy Hodgson being famed for not knowing what to do with those players. That for me was Roy Hodgson's England tenure. He picked players that were, and actually this is interesting. I'd be interested to see whether Gareth Southgate's approach, which I really admire, his new approach works better, because Gareth Southgate's approach is, if you are injured, I do not care who you are, I do not care how successful you've been, if you are not fit enough to play or if you're coming back from injury, I'm not going to pick you because it is a waste of time. And I think that is, you know, exactly the right approach. You pick, you don't necessarily pick the best players, and I'm not just blaming Roy Hodgson for this, because our ridiculous tabloid culture over here builds up these players, and we're constantly told by, you know, the idiots on Match of the Day, and you know, all the pundits hype up these players, and you know, you're told, oh, you have to pick Dele Alli because he is the best player, etc, etc. And I really like Gareth Southgate actually kind of saying, do you know what, no, I'm not picking crocked Wayne Rooney. I'm not picking someone that's done their metatarsal 8 weeks previously before a major tournament. What is the point? It's not going to work. And that was the exact opposite to what Roy Hodgson used to do. I always got the impression that Roy Hodgson was the slightly nerdy, unpopular kid at school that had somehow made it into the big-time cool gang and was desperately trying to kind of cling on. I think that it's, you know, I'm quite offended on Frank de Boer's behalf, actually, that Roy Hodgson has now waded in and said, oh, you know, you shouldn't pick, you know, you're not picking the right players. Look, mate, we had 4 years of England being horrendous that then climaxed in us losing to footballing giants Iceland because you did not know, A, how to pick the right team, and B, how to get the best out of that team. I don't feel particularly optimistic about Crystal Palace's chances, I must say.
I wish Roy Hodgson would climb out of his ravine of denial.
Absolutely. Yes.
I heard him.
It's never his fault, is it? It's
no, anyone else. I heard him interviewed on the radio this week, just after he'd been appointed, and he was asked about England's dismal performance, as you say, at Euro 2016. And he hustled out some absolute nonsense about being, or he was overall very satisfied with his time as England manager. And I just wanted him to be honest and say, oh, it was terrible. I got a lot of things wrong. You know, I really have learned from it. You know, it was a terrible period. But he just kept clinging to his kind of ladder of denial. And, you know, no one would think less of him for telling the truth.
And absolutely. I think a lot more of him. And you know, and that way I don't feel that the mess that Crystal Palace are in is going to be cleaned up by him anytime soon.
I think you're right. Now, if Top of the Pops return next week, would you bother watching it? Music on the Telly, that's next after Prince.
Drawn to those ones that weren't afraid. Remember you told me love was touching souls. Sure you touched mine. Part of you pours out of me from time to time. These lines. Thank you.
could drink a case of you, darling. Oh yeah, yeah. And I'd still be on my feet. I'd still be on my feet. Still be on my feet. I'd still.
I have to rein myself in. Purple rein myself in, he says.
Very good.
Because I could easily pick a track from Prince every week, but that's something of a rarity, and it's from an album called A Tribute to Joni Mitchell that has some lovely performances on it, including from Bjork and Sufjan Stevens. The album is from 2007, and covering Joni Mitchell and a track from her album Blue, that was Prince and A Case of You.
Well, as you see, if I can rein myself in not to pick Radiohead and PJ Harvey every single week, yeah, I think you're able to purple rein yourself, excellent, by the way, rein yourself in with Prince, or as I like to call him, much of the chagrin of a friend of mine who's a very big fan of Prince, P. Rince. I always call him P. Rince, so that I then get my friend going, stop calling him P. Rince, which is, you know, extremely enjoyable. So, yes, Mr. P. Rince, I'm always a fan.
That's like your Donald T. Rump
Absolutely. And also my friend refers to the popular actor George C. Looney. I mean, it's something that never fails to work.
Every now and again, a newspaper column pops up suggesting that there's a clamour for the return of Top of the Pops on UK television.
But I think there's just a clamour from editors for copy from copy, overworked journalists, right, isn't there, really?
For listeners elsewhere around the world, Top of the Pops was, as the name suggests, a weekly TV show that presented live-ish performances or videos of the biggest selling chart singles of that particular week. It ran from 1964 to 2006, by which time it had pretty much run out of steam and
By the way, my favourite live performance on Top of the Pops story was I can't remember, it might have been on Jules Holland or something. I saw Bernard Sumner from New Order go on something once, and they showed footage of them singing on Top of the Pops, and his vocals were a bit off key, shall we say, and after he said our record sales always, the idea was if you got your record on Top of the Pops, it would increase your sales because more people would see you performing. And Bernard Sumner said, our records always went down after on Top of the Pops because they didn't always perform well in that arena, shall we say.
Oh, I'm now in a situation that echoes the generation before me that raised their eyebrows at Boy George and wondered why those Bananarama girls didn't wear some nice dresses. I'm out of touch with the top 40. Would a rebooted 30-minute showcase tempt us into keeping tabs on the latest chart action? Josie, if Top of the Pops was revived, would you watch it?
I would try, I think, because like you, I'm a bit out of touch with the top 40 now, partly because I'm not interested in it, I'm more interested in alternative things, but also, yeah, in a way, I think, well, you know, maybe I should know these things. I have no idea what's number one, I kind of feel that it was, you know, I don't think I can complain, oh, it's all nonsense in the top 40 if I'm taking no interest in it. And part of the reason why I'm taking no interest in it is that if you don't want to listen to Radio 1 all day, and I can completely understand that, or commercial radio, there are no other ways really of logging into what's going on, I suppose. So whether or not there is a clamour for it, I don't know. Having said that, I think we've talked before on this very podcast about how young people consume things and how young people largely consume YouTube and things like that now, and how Radio 1 particularly are starting to move into offering a lot of content online as well as sort of on FM radio, because that's how young people consume things. I don't know. Maybe having Top of the Pops on TV would broaden access. I can understand why people that are, you know, without putting too fine a point on it, very old, Terence, would not want to get involved in. would not want to get involved in that, you know, sort of the melee of pop. But I feel that it would help people like me who are in the sort of 30s to 40s bracket, who are too old for Radio 1. I remember laughing with a friend of mine once because Radio 1's official remit was meant to be 18 to 34. And at the age of 28, I said to her, God, Radio 1, I have to listen to it at work. It's a right old bracket. And she went, I went, but we're in the bracket. And she went, Juliet, they don't want us. And it's true. It is more of an 18 to 24 bracket now for Radio 1. you know, I do enjoy Six Music. That's my favourite station because it's kind of a midpoint between Radio 1 and Radio 2 and a bit alternative. But I do really like pop. I think pop done perfectly is a brilliant thing. And in a way, if it was on telly for half an hour whilst I was getting my tea, I probably would watch it and I would probably take some interest in it. And I think it might not necessarily serve for young people anymore so much, but I think it would serve. I hate the idea that you have this kind of apartheid in pop when you get to a certain age. Even if you want to take an interest in it, it's really difficult to. So actually, for me, that would work. Although you could then go on to argue, and perhaps we can talk about this now, whether or not pop, Top of the Pops, has died out because pop is less interesting now. I don't know. There's a site called Pop Justice, which is fantastic. I recommend that anybody read Pop Justice. It's written by Peter Robinson largely, and it is great. And he was tweeting this thing the other day. Obviously, I can't give it its full title because this is a family program, but he calls it the Effing Hell Prize. And he said there was £100 up for grabs this year from his, what he calls his Effing Hell Prize, which is basically that a pop act makes you say effing hell. And there's very sort of strict criteria to this. I'm trying to find it now because it's quite, he's quite peculiar. He's quite sort of particular about how he wants things to be here. And actually, in a way, this did get me thinking about whether or not this was kind of how it should be, really. The idea that it doesn't necessarily, it has to be a great song that is well produced, but that's not enough. It has to do something completely different.
Kind of makes you stop in your tracks and go,
yeah.
Wow.
And he said that, you know, Girls Aloud, for example, apart from their rather drippy ballads, all of the up-tempo Girls Aloud numbers were events. Their singles genuinely were pop events. Hung Up by Madonna, that was a pop event. And so he kind of wants something, sort of an Azalea Banks or a Lady Gaga or someone to do something, really. But then having said that, having watched some of the old Top of the Pops that are on recently on BBC4, most of it is, you know, I think a lot of pop has always been very average. You remember the good bits and remember the bad bits.
This is
but
the
a lot
point.
Of it is always very average.
It's very, looking at those old Top of the Pops that are being rerun, largely it's very disappointing. I'm not sure in the modern era now, though. I think it would have to be video-based if it was brought back, because I don't think many acts would want to bother turning up at a London studio to try and replicate complicated recording studio sounds for a TV show when they can stick a video up on their website, or, as you say, more likely YouTube, and gain much more traction for their music that way. And the thing is, as we're talking about those old Top of the Pops reruns, TV has never, mostly through the restrictions of the medium, been able to get the soul and heart of music across through the screen. And look at the... I was thinking about this. Look at the number of times I've made snarky comments about Glastonbury and the awfulness of some band or other, only for people quite rightly to come back at me and say, yeah, but the thing is, you're watching it on TV in your living room. You can't feel the atmosphere and the excitement. And, you know, that's a very, very valid point. And I think, you know, I've genuinely learned from it. I think it's true for almost all music television. The two-dimensional format of it all just doesn't get the emotion across. And I think when in our minds we think that it was very exciting watching Top of the Pops in the 80s, and as I said earlier, you know, Boy George and Bananarama, I think it was because it was pretty grim looking back, but it was all we had. There was nothing else. And so it became an event, and almost by the very fact that there were Spandau Ballet or Duran Duran or Elvis Costello actually on the telly in primetime TV, and your parents were, you know, saying, is that a boy or a girl? was kind of exciting in itself. And I just don't think it would work now. I vote no to a Top of the Pops revival. And by the way, I'd happily see the end of X Factor, The Voice, and any other of their ilk. As for them too, I think the party is over. Music on television, it doesn't work.
I'm not entirely sure that I agree with your blanket dismissal of it, but why should I get in the way of a Terence soapbox moment?
Now, if there were to be a new music show on television, I'd campaign that you should be presenting it.
Well, that's very kind. Thank you very much.
On that note, you'll be wowing the crowds with your appearances hither and thither this week.
Well, it would seem so, yes. I am off to DJ this evening. I DJ as part of a pair of us called Sheila's Take a Bow with good friend Letty. We are appearing at the Palace in Hastings this evening from 8 o'clock, I believe. So if you would like to pop down, we just play records and bump into each other, basically. That's kind of what we do. Surf, glam, indie, all sorts of things, really. So I'm doing that. I'll be back with Indie Wonderland next Wednesday, 8 to 10pm, barricaderadio.com, where I'll be doing sort of, I think I'll be doing a Mercury show next week, because we've had the Mercury Music Prize this week. So I'll be reviewing the nominees and the winner next week.
We've spent many a happy podcast over the last few years moaning about the Mercury Prize this year.
Absolutely, yeah, indeed. And my increasingly desperate attempts to kind of defend it.
Thanks to the woman who is always top of our pops.
Executive
producer Rona. And out we go today with a track from the early adventures of Nick Cave.
Indeed, yes. Again, inspired by my trip to Oxford, I went and looked in a graphic novel and comic book shop, which was excellent, had a great range of things. And a Nick Cave graphic novel has been released based on the songs of Nick Cave. I was really impressed by it. And on my way home, you know, the universe always matches up, Terence. It always kind of, you know, falls into place. And I was listening to, I've subscribed to Apple Music a while ago, and it sends me playlists, which I very much enjoy. Mm. And it sent me a kind of a sort of what it calls a deep cuts playlist of various kind of post-punky type things, and this was on it, and I really enjoyed it. I thought it was superb. So having not heard it before, I thought I'd play it, because it is, you know, slightly honkingly mad in the way that Nick Cave's stuff always is. It was next to PIL on this playlist, so it's kind of fitted, I thought, really. But I really enjoyed this. So this is The Birthday Party, and this is Mr. Clarinet.
I have a friend in you. You have been listening to a DACM Media production.